So you'll see that this, I have some slides that probably you've already seen earlier here, but this is, again, a switch back to focusing on what states are doing with using data from one state, Massachusetts, and you can sort of see this as a state that has probably been implementing healthcare reform for longer than any other state. So it's maybe a view of what other states might be looking like in the future. And I certainly want to acknowledge the contributions of my collaborators here. This is funded by NIDA. And the data were supplied by the Massachusetts Executive Office of Health and Human Services. And I need to say that I'm not speaking for either one of these, just for ourselves, and we have no other conflicts of interest. So this is a slide that you've already seen. I think the only thing that I would say is that there's also naltrexone is another alternative for treatment of opioid addiction. It came on the market in 2010 and is mostly administered by injection, the long-acting use. You can administer in pill form, but it's not widely used, and it's not included in our study at the moment. So you've already heard that drug-free treatment has widely varying results, and meta-analyses show that methadone and buprenorphine are significantly more effective in preventing relapse and promoting abstinence than drug-free treatment. Methadone is slightly more effective in most of those studies, but that's somewhat dose-dependent. Now, there are a lot of concerns publicly about medication-assisted treatment, and many of you have probably heard these before. Certainly something that's getting a lot of play these days is diversion of buprenorphine. There is significant evidence that buprenorphine has been widely diverted. It's easier to divert than methadone. I could give another talk and say that that's maybe not such a bad thing because it doesn't have the same abuse potential as methadone. Methadone is certainly more dangerous in terms of overdose, which leads to the reason for it being more highly regulated in how it's dispensed. There's a lot of concern about long-term maintenance and of people on opioid agonist therapy, and that's really what I'm going to be talking about mostly today. But another overlay to this is public opinion. And you can just see from some of the news clips I have here that shows up in the popular press pretty often. This concern is we're just substituting one opioid for another. And that applies a lot of pressure to policymakers. So these have certainly had their impact on Medicaid program decisions for how they regulate opioid agonist therapy. Methadone maintenance is pretty limited in many, many states. Some that's just a supply issue, and others it's a Medicaid coverage issue. But one thing that's happened over the past few years is that Medicaid programs have started, due to some of these concerns that I described earlier, imposing lifetime limits on the duration of treatment. Now, I want to emphasize this is what they will pay for. It doesn't mean that you can't continue to get treatment and pay for it yourself, but that's not very realistic for most folks who are Medicaid beneficiaries. So currently, there this is shifting almost weekly. Currently, I know that there are at least 11 states that now have lifetime limits on duration of medication-assisted treatment. And I want to focus on a few questions about those policies. First, just how many long-term users are there? There are a lot of myths out there that some people are on it for their entire lifetime, for 20, 40 years. And certainly you can find cases that support that. But, you know, the larger question is how many people are there really who these policies might affect? what might be the effects of those restricted policies, and that gets to the question, sort of a sub-question of how many people might actually be required to end their treatment due to some of these lifetime limits. Other questions are, you know, are non-drug treatments for opioid addiction a viable alternative? So if you can no longer get your medication-assisted treatment funded, then by default you may shift to drug-free treatment. And then finally, the question that might be behind some of these policies, although in some states say, state it explicitly, others don't, but there's a notion that they can save some money by restricting lifetime, putting lifetime limits on length of treatment. So to look at this issue, we used Medicaid claims from Massachusetts starting with 2004, which is about 1 year after buprenorphine became available in Massachusetts through the Medicaid program. And we've used claims through 2010. So this is over 56,000 Medicaid beneficiaries, and it represents over 108,000 episodes of treatment. And we only include episodes that lasted longer than 3 months to make sure we're not picking up people who are using buprenorphine for detox or for other short-term uses. And our definition of an episode is that you have to have a break of at least 60 days before a treatment is then classified as a new episode. I've already said we used Medicaid claims. We merged this with other Department of Public Health treatment data because the Department of Public Health offers some free detoxification services, and detoxification is a key variable in the study. So we linked that. And then we developed a claims-based definition of a relapse event, which is simply someone had a detoxification or they were admitted to an emergency room or an inpatient facility with a primary diagnosis of a substance use disorder. So we compared buprenorphine, methadone, and lumped all the other non-medication treatments together. We looked at episode length, how many relapses per month individuals had, and the Medicaid expenditures per month, and adjusted for demographics and other clinical characteristics. And we followed people for up to 36 months. So if you remember, the longest duration of these state policies goes up to 36 months, so we think this is a reasonable test of that. Now, this is a slide that I don't expect you to be able to read from the back, but just the red figures here highlight that there are differences in these groups. There's some sorting. This is a real-world study, so this is not a clinical trial. People who use these different treatments tend to have different characteristics. So just to name a few, the folks in the other group tended to be a little older. We had more people with severe mental illness in that group. We had more people with a co-occurring alcohol disorder in that group. In the buprenorphine group, we had more people who were, had a diagnosis of abusing another type of drug. And then you can see that the Medicaid expenditures were really quite different, with buprenorphine folks being the least expensive and the other group being the most expensive. And then relapses during treatment, something that we'll get to shortly. You can see there's a pretty big difference there. So this is just a graphic representation of how long people remain in treatment. So just to walk you through this, the green line is the other non-medication treatment. The red line is methadone. The blue line is buprenorphine. Across the bottom, those are months going from 1 to 36. And these are just a number of episodes that make it to that point. So you can see there's a very rapid drop-off in the other group. Not a whole lot of people make it past 6 months in that group. And you can see that methadone is the best in terms of maintaining people in treatment over long periods of time, and that buprenorphine also retains people at a somewhat lower rate. I think an easier way to look at this is just to look at in terms of how many people made it to checkpoints. So in the buprenorphine group, almost two-thirds of the people made it to 6 months. Almost 80% of the people in the methadone group made it to 6 months. But by 6 months, more than half of the people in the other group had already stopped treatment. Looking at a year, which is the duration that several states use, a third of the people using buprenorphine were still in treatment. Slightly over half of the methadone maintenance folks were still in treatment, but only 12% of the other group remained in treatment. Going all the way out to 36 months, you see there really aren't a whole lot of people out there that make it to 36 months in this particular state, in this particular Medicaid program. 5% of the folks with using buprenorphine, just under 10 for methadone, and less than 1% of the people who started out using other forms of treatment were still getting treatment. And if you look at these are very unique individuals. So if you remember all the differences we looked at there, we wanted to control for some of those. So we used Cox proportional hazards models to predict time to first relapse and generalized estimating equations for the cost comparisons and adjusting for a range of things that you saw in that chart. But also in addition, for the cost, we adjusted for prior cost history for each individual. We adjusted in the relapse equation for relapses prior to the current episode, so in the 6 months immediately preceding that episode, how many relapses did they have. Again, this is a graphic representation of relapse rates. So green is other, blue is buprenorphine, and red is methadone. And this is pretty much consistent with what you see in clinical trials. You can see the green line is way above the other two lines, much higher relapse rates. But relapse rates are declining over time for all of these groups. So, you know, the longer you stay in treatment, the fewer relapses you have. Not that much difference by the end between buprenorphine and methadone. But the other group, even those unique individuals who make it all the way to 36 months, are still relapsing at higher rates. So this is the time to relapse model. You can see that there's several things that have a strong impact on relapse, and this co-occurring alcohol abuse is something we see in a lot of our analyses. It has a huge impact on relapse rates. But the key numbers here are the last two hazard rates there, which show that buprenorphine users are about two-thirds less likely to relapse than people in the other group. And folks in the methadone group are even lower than that, about a quarter of the hazard rate there. So much less likely to relapse when we control for all of these differences that we can control for here. Now, looking at expenditures, this gets to the question of, can states save some money by doing this? The green line is the other. That's consistently above the others, so we're consistently spending more money on people who are not involved in medication-assisted treatment. I should say that this is total healthcare costs. We find there's a whole lot of shifting that goes on here so that treating substance abuse doesn't just reduce behavioral health costs, it also has an impact on physical health care costs as well. So our view is the best way to look at this is total health care costs. Here you can see there's really not much change in methadone over time. That gets billed at a pretty constant rate, and it stays pretty flat, and there's a slight decrease in buprenorphine over time. So again, the longer you can stay in treatment, the less you will cost a Medicaid program. But consistently, buprenorphine is less expensive than methadone when you consider total healthcare costs. And we have another article that has shown this as well. So looking at the costs, adjusting for all of those other factors, I'll just direct you to the bottom two lines there, which show that compared to other forms of non-medication-assisted treatment, that buprenorphine is almost $400 per month less expensive than non-medication-assisted treatment. Methadone treatment, about $150, $146 to be exact there, controlling for those other things that we can control for. So not much chance that you're going to actually save money by shifting people off of opioid addiction treatment or opioid agonist treatment. And in fact, you might very well increase your costs. So there are a lot of limitations to using administrative data here. These data were used primarily for billing, not for research. This is a non-randomized study, so we can only control for those things that we can see. It's not like a randomized design that would maybe control for some things that you can't observe. And, you know, if we were doing this in another setting, we would are using other data. We would want to include outcomes like abstinence, arrest, incarceration, and death. And actually, those last three we are including in our study and are working on some analyses of that right now. But the conclusions are that most treatment episodes last less than 2 years. So not a lot of people are going to be affected by these new policies. Relapse rates are lower for medication-assisted treatment. Medicaid costs are lower for medication-assisted treatment. And relapses and costs decrease with longer treatment. So anything that interrupts treatment may actually lead to higher relapse rates and higher costs. So 6 month treatment limits, which I think there's only one state that still has a 6 month treatment limit, but that would affect most of the people getting opioid-assisted treatment. It's very unlikely that any of these policies will improve help for individuals who are being treated or save the state any money. In fact, they're likely to increase costs and result in worse health outcomes. And current non-drug treatment just really does not seem to be a dependable alternative to medication-assisted treatment. If you look at all of those analyses we showed you, I think non-opioid agonist treatment was doing more poorly in virtually all of those.